Welcome to the continued podcast adventures of three opinionated guys with mics and too much free time. Strong enough to stop a speeding movie rumor, more powerful than a bad comic book event. Able to waste hours of time asking stupid questions to people who have better things to do. It's Dave, Ben, and John. It's Superhero Speak.
How do you pronounce your last name?
Schumacher.
That's what I thought. And then Burton.
Yes.
There has to have been jokes made.
We're both
named after insanely popular filmmakers.
Well, depends on your definition of popular, but yes.
Well, Joel Schumacher is not popular. Well, he's Batman.
Yeah.
Well, he's well known for killing the Batman franchise.
Right.
He's the only director that's gone. Well, not the only director, but he's pretty prolific. Where he's like, he goes on. Someone asks him about Batman and Robin. He's like, look, I'm sorry. I want to tell all the fans. I want to tell everybody. I'm sorry. They wanted me to make a family friendly Batman, so I went wild with colors. I'm sorry.
Yeah, because the colors were the only thing wrong.
It was that
not the balloon. Dude, the puns were the only good part.
Well, the puns were. Have you seen the CinemaSins on Batman and Robin?
Oh yeah.
It's like Mr. Freeze is like, let's chill, and then they went through like 60 puns. They're like, really, really. Oh, so this is where you hang out. Oh crap! Oh, they're hanging upside down and shit. So I was like, what the.
Wait, hang on a second. So he had to make a family-friendly Batman, right?
Yeah.
So what is he trying to say? The two movies before it weren't family-friendly? Those were all family-friendly Batman.
No,
like, I don't know. That. I think that's a cocky meme.
Well,
Burton
got a lot of flack for Batman Returns being too dark, especially the Penguin, because McDonald's had Happy Meals with Penguin toys, but the kids didn't want them because the movie was too dark. So, yeah.
That sucks. McDonald's like, we're going to make a lot of money this way.
We're screwed then because there's never going to be an inheritance Happy Meal.
Yeah. There'll be an inheritance Happy Meal. I'll make sure that happens.
Yeah, right. If Betsy popped out of a Happy Meal, most of the kids, if they ever saw the comic, are going to run screaming.
That'd be awesome. That's the point. That's like, scare your kids. Come to McDonald's. Buy them this toy. They'll scare them.
Scare your kids with Danny DeVito with shark teeth eating raw fish. Yeah. The problem wasn't that the movie was too dark. It's that Danny DeVito played a horrific penguin. Not that he was bad at it, but the character was horrific.
Yes.
I mean, come on. It was like some weird mutant penguin. It was like...
Mutant penguin.
Yeah, basically, like
that was penguin. That was penguin if he was bitten by a radioactive penguin.
Exactly, it was like radioactive PCP smoking penguin.
I don't think it was. I think it was more meth.
Okay, there you go. Meth penguin.
He looked more meth.
Okay, I'm behind that.
If it was like the LSD penguin, it'd be like the movie Happy Feet. A really big guy dressed as a penguin dancing and shit.
That really depends on how your trip goes, bro. There's people that completely fall in the other direction.
But he'd end it with grabbing one of the penguins and biting their heads off.
Oh, that would scar children. That little fishies. Here, kids, look at this penguin. Oh my god, the penguin just...
I totally don't remember that. I must have blocked it out.
Okay.
Like, no.
All right. For those who are listening, you are listening to Superhero Speak. I'm your host, Dave.
And John.
And we are talking to Burton and Schumacher, but though we're talking about Batman Returns, we're not talking about Tim Burton. We're not talking to Tim Burton and Joel Schumacher. Yeah. We're talking to James Burton and James Schumacher, the creative force behind Inheritance from Outpouring Comics. How are you guys doing?
Fantastic.
And some difference.
Splendiferous, is that a word?
It is now.
Yes.
He's willed it into existence. It's like, if it doesn't exist, it exists now. It's like, hey.
It's right next to Nervous Sighted and Hangry.
Yeah, what kind of an ego do you have to like make him a word and go, it exists now? Sorry.
You have to be the bard levels of ego, right?
Hey, how many? I'm a storytelling bard.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Right, right. I mean, writers are allowed to make up words, I think.
Exactly.
Yeah. Touché.
Except James is the artist. I'm the writer.
Well, that's true.
So he's the artist making up his own words. It's like, hey, look at this. Look at me. I don't even need the English language. I'll just make it up.
What exactly. All through history, artists have had an excuse to be crazy, and I'm not going to change that anytime soon.
I'm just waiting to see which one of us is going to cut our ear off and become the new Vincent Van Gogh. Okay.
I guess I could.
Neither. You could live with one ear. I could. Well,
does it count that I'm deaf in one ear?
Possibly.
Yes, you can cut that ear off.
Possibly. All right, I'll get right on that.
Score.
All right, so the splendiferous one. I'll start with you. We normally kind of start these things out. Tell us a little bit about yourself and art, and was comic books something you always wanted to do? How did you, become an artist?
Okay.
No pressure.
Yeah. I just
go
got
the hard-hitting stuff right out the.
She was laughing because somebody just asked me that in a convention, and they did it on like live television, and I cracked like an egg.
Can you create that for us right now?
If that's a high pressure question, I got to throw the rest of these out because I've been scanning Twitter and everything, and
you'll hear why in a sec. So, I have known I wanted to draw comics and do art since I was 4 years old. When I was four, my dad worked out of town, and he had to travel back and forth. Every Friday night he'd come home, and Sunday night he'd leave. And my whole mission in life at 4 years old was to hang out with my dad, who is this big, bigger-than-life outlaw biker meth cook guy. Okay, so one weekend he brought me home a chalkboard, and he said, "Son, I want you to draw me naked ladies and motorcycles." So I spent the entire week drawing naked ladies and motorcycles every single day on this chalkboard, filling every single inch of it just to make him happy when he got home. And he's no longer with us. I lost him in 2010, 2 weeks before my son was born. And a year after losing my house and my career, and 2 years after surviving cancer. So it's all kind of wrapped up in all of those emotions. So I draw and I tell stories because when I was 4 years old, my dad saw that in me, and he gave me my very first means to share that kind of part of myself with everybody. And I basically still draw naked ladies and motorcycles for him on a daily basis.
I don't know what you did on live television, but that was a beautiful answer. Do you still have the chalkboard?
No. To describe my childhood, I will just use the word unstable.
All right.
And it's kind of a very long, drawn-out story that is probably meant for a mental health podcast. But I don't have that stuff. But he bought me my first comic books. Mm-hmm. When I was 13, I won the California Scholarship of the Arts program, and I was able to go do a semester at CalArts, which is this gigantic art school, at 13. And he's the one who took me down there and made sure that I went. And I don't know. He always knew that that's what was inside of me, and he was always, like, super encouraging, even though he was, like, totally incapable of all that. I think he had, like, a fourth grade reading level, something like that. That wasn't in him, but he totally support. I mean, this is a guy, he hated sci-fi. He hated fantasy crap. And his oldest son, his namesake, is this kid who's like obsessed with Jim Henson and freaking runs around the house with a towel tied around his neck and with a t-shirt that's super Jamie on it and pretends that he's a superhero jumping out of closets and crap. And he, instead of like saying, "No, son, you're going to play football here," or "No, son, you need to stand up by bullies by breaking their legs," or whatever. Instead, he just said, "You go be a nerd. Here's a comic book, and have fun with it."
Well, that's, I think that's the only thing you can do as a parent. I think parents who try to force their kids into things that just don't make them happy don't have successful kids.
Exactly.
Yeah. I would definitely take that. I mean, the chaos and the craziness aside, my parents gave me a lot of freedom, and that's probably the most thankful thing that I can say about the way I grew up was there was a lot of freedom to be who I wanted to be, and something I appreciate greatly. But as far as art goes, I've done a couple of small anthologies, and I've been an editorial illustrator. My day job has kind of taken a lot of time and energy out of me for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of collapsed at work and woke up one morning to find out I had level 4 lymphoma.
Ooh.
And they basically say, hey, you may die any minute. And, yeah. We can't treat you here. You need to be in San Francisco. And the insurance company wouldn't actually pay for me to go to San Francisco. So my best friend had to basically kidnap me out of the hospital and take me down there for treatment. And when I was going through all that, it was really harsh. My daughter had just been born, and I hadn't really got to spend time with her. And all that kind of beat up onto me. And I promised myself 3 things when I got out of the hospital. The first thing is that I would see her graduate kindergarten. The second thing is that I would see my work finally get into print and concentrate on that instead of running warehouses for huge corporations. And the third one was to rebuild this old Harley, which I'm 99% done with. So I'm doing pretty good. I got 2 out of 3 so far, and inheritance being out is definitely knocking that third one out of the ballpark.
Cool.
Oh, yeah.
And then Mr. Schumacher, did your father make you write stories about naked women when you were a child?
No, truthfully, in all honesty, I got raised in a family. My dad was a photographer, and my mother was a writer her entire life. She was a business major, so they both were business people, so they both had the business aspect to it. But we're normal kids. I was like James was, except I was more a Ghostbuster fanatic and all that kind of stuff instead of a Superman fanatic.
Mm-hmm.
But it was when I was 11 years old that we got sat down, and my parents sat my entire family down. And we're sitting there with my mom, the look on my mom's face is just tells you immediately that something bad is coming. Mm-hmm. And
right.
They're like, yeah, your mom has cancer. Oh. And we're just like, wait, what? And I started weeping. Because my mother and I are close,
mm-hmm.
The two closest people in our family. And so I'm sitting there as a kid. I'm like, wait a second. And then my dad says it's not the good kind. They're going to have to do aggressive chemotherapy. And this is back in 94, something like that. 94, right. Okay. 92. So she started being treated for cancer. And they started doing aggressive chemotherapy. And the chemotherapy she was in, she was the only surviving member that survived chemotherapy. So when I was a young kid, we're dealing with this interaction of having to potentially lose my mother at a young age. And I remember this one time I watched her, she was watching a movie and she was laughing. And it just kind of clicked in my brain that something was clicking to her. And my dad brought home a VHS camera and I stole the camera and I'm going to make a movie. So I drew my own little name on it. I called it a Schumacher film. So I shot my first little film. I had my own first little slate and stuff. But what predicated this moment was my mother was in the bathroom throwing up after a treatment of chemotherapy while my dad was having to work. Because my father worked damn near 2 jobs just to be able to keep my mother alive and to keep us in a house and stuff. So I never got to hang out with my dad. And I remember holding onto my mom's hair and she's crying and it's coming out in my hands. Mm-hmm. So at a young age, that kind of just changes your whole dynamic and how the world appears to you. So then when I saw my mom watching a television show and it made her laugh, it kind of put that fire in me that, okay, I'm going to try something and see if I can make her laugh and stuff. So I ended up making her laugh and I realized then that it's possible to create stuff that can help people forget about the pain and the loss and the tragedy that's in their lives. So I got very lucky at a young age to have the awareness of what I was to become at a very young age, because most people don't realize that for a while. But throughout the years, throughout that following year, my mother literally fought tooth and nail for life. It was like, we're getting ready to okay, this is not going to end well. As a kid, I couldn't handle it. My dad did his best because my dad is the trooper in this whole thing, along with my mother. But my mother throughout the entire time was so selfless in everything that she did that the chemotherapy was so painful that she actually, it was causing us to not be able to eat. So she would give up her pain meds in order for us to eat. So they wouldn't, she wouldn't fill the prescription so that the, us kids could have food and stuff. So from a very young age, I was sculpted and understood that life is filled with pain. And you can't run from it. You can't escape it. The only thing you could do is harness it and utilize it and change the world with it. So that's literally what I started doing for a long time. I started writing short stories, short little novellas, short little films. I made little movies when I was like 12, and then I started making movies again when I was 16. And then I just kept making them, and I ended up graduating from high school. I got a job at a television station, rose quickly to the rank of a director, started directing live television, and just kind of stuck. And then 2005, my mother got diagnosed with cancer again. And this time it had spread into both breasts. So my dad ended up again picking up more overtime to be able to help compensate. I left television to go take a job at a government agency so I can get paid more so I can help them and stuff. So I stopped making films for a while. And then in 2009, one of those horrible days, I woke up at 7:15 in the morning to my father, who was a military man, who had never called me anything besides you. He was like, "Hey, you. You come here." Right. So, all right. And the first thing out of his voice, out of his mouth, was "baby." And I was like, "Oh my God." And my whole world came crashing inwards. Because my mother was my rock. Very much like James's dad is his rock. My mother was the person who I went to with everything, every problem I had, every story I had. And she was the person that would give me the straight dope. She's like, if it's terrible, she's like, "That's terrible."
I'm like, right.
I'm like, "Fine, it's terrible." And then, I love her for that because she taught me at a very young age in my career that take criticism with a grain of salt. Enjoy it. Appreciate it. Love it. Because you're not going to get every single person to love it. You're not going to get every single person to hate it. She's like, you'll stay sane a lot longer if you can tolerate it and stuff. So in 2009 through 2010, I consider it what I call the dead year, where I barely did anything. The only good thing that came out of that was I met Zara, and then James Burt responded to an ad I put out. I was trying to make a little movie and stuff. I put out an ad on Craigslist that I said, "Hey, I need a storyboard artist." And I had a couple people show up. They're like, "Okay, cool." James shows up and he immediately starts talking Evil Dead. And I'm like, "Oh, cool. He knows exactly what I like." And he starts talking about like other movies. And I was like, "Okay, this guy knows exactly." And on top of that, he's a damn good artist. So
Army of Darkness is the greatest film ever made.
So like, he left, and then he left my office, and I'm sitting there, I'm like, okay, and I ended up calling him, and I think he picked up with his wife and kids, but I'm like, "Hey, dude, let's work together." He's like, "Dude, totally." So he started doing storyboards, and then over the next, like, 3 or 4 years, it kept going and going and going, and then Inheritance came out of a dark moment where, after a film of mine was stolen and purposefully destroyed by people, I was like, I want to do something that, what?
You're going to have to continue your story, but you're going to have to go back to that one.
I will.
Everybody always asks about that because it sounds so dramatic.
But I was talking to James. And I'm like, "Look, this is pissed me off. I need to do something." And the one thing I promised my mother was that I would take her the story that she had in our childhood and our relationships and turn it into a book. And that's literally the basis of Inheritance. 2 days before my mother passed away, she calls me, and it was June 6th. I remember the day exactly. She calls me and says, "Hey, buddy, I need you to come over to my house." I'm like, "Okay." My dad was at work, so I get there, and she's crying. And I'm like, "What's going on?" She's like, "I'm dying." I'm like, "You're not dying." She literally died a month and a half before that. And she's sitting there going, "I'm dying." I'm like, "No, you're not. You'll be fine." She's like, "No, I'm dying. This nice young doctor came in. He told me I'm dying. I can eat whatever I want." I'm like, "Okay, what do you want to eat? If you're not..." And I'm thinking, okay, this is a doctor telling her this and stuff. And it's probably true. So she asked me for a cheeseburger and some ice cream, so I got it for her. And then we're sitting there talking, and the last thing she ever told me was I got up to leave, and she said, "Hey, Bo." And my nickname with her was Bo, or her little Manny. And I'm like, "What's up?" That's the moment where I wish I would have stayed. But she sat there and it's still tough to talk about this. Jesus. She's like, "No matter what, no matter how hard it gets, don't quit filmmaking and don't quit writing." She's like, "If you knew what was coming, don't quit filmmaking and don't quit writing." I was like, "Okay." And during that month and a half before she died, when she actually died in the hospital, she died twice. The first time she died in the hospital, she actually went to the other side. And she met her father. She met her mother. She was out of pain. She wasn't in a cancer-riddled body and stuff. So she was given specific instructions to tell the kids and stuff. And mine was to not quit filmmaking no matter how hard it got. And I haven't. And that filmmaking and that promised her taking my artwork to another level has led us to the point we're at now. I did a film called The Astronaut, which is based off my father's life. Mm-hmm. On my father and I's interactions, because we never hung out with each other until after my mom died. And then he almost died in 2013. So I shot a film called The Astronaut. It made people weep. It was accepted into the Festival de Cannes, the short film corner. So we went to France with the film.
Wow.
I just was nominated for best director at AOF. It's a festival coming up this week. It made a bunch of impressions with a bunch of people. People loved it. And I was like, okay, this is great. And then last year, I think it was 2013 when James and I started working on Inheritance. And it was kind of a slow pace. We're like, okay, let's see how this works and stuff. I would send James test pages. Then I'd send him a full script. It's like, I love this. Let's go ahead and do this. So we got 4 pages into what we call our prologue issue, which is out now. And I said, hey, James, I just submitted it for an award. And he's like, what? I'm like, I just submitted us into a competition for best artwork. And he's like, can I swear?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Go ahead.
He's like, you dickbag. He's like, why? I'm like, because it's good. And so
wait, hang on a second. He's not talking about the scope about who I was up against.
He's leaving that out. All right, so the guy that we were up against for best artwork, I can't remember his name, it's escaping me, but the guy's artwork is amazing. He is the vehicular designer and conceptual artist of Mad Max Fury Road.
Jeez. Okay.
And so James was like, shit. He just was like, that literally is what he said. When I told him that, he's like, shit. I'm like, dude, we're going to do it. We're going to kick ass. This is great. It's amazing. This artwork's awesome. People love it. People saw the posters. Or the little cover, and they're like, holy, what is this? This is incredible. And we get to the award ceremony, and we wait till like the end of it. We're like, okay, and then best artwork comes up, and I'm like, okay, great. James is sitting next to me, and James is not so much rocking, but you could see it in his head where he's like, okay, please, please, please. And then they announced the runner-up, and then they announced the winner. I remember I stood up, and James is already to the stage. He's like, bam, let's go. And he gets up there. So I do this nice speech. I thank James. James was so terrified about forgetting his awesome wife that he forgot me.
Yeah. So, I've never woken up in the middle of the night with you standing over me with a pillow.
Going, hey, you forgot me.
Every time we tell this story, he's got to make sure everybody knows I forgot to thank him.
So a lot of my artwork, a lot of my writing comes from pain. It's built on pain. I thrive off of pain, so to speak. It's the fuel that lights the fire that allows me to create. And it's the thing to me that unites everybody else above all else, even above love, is loss. Because at some point, whether you lose your dog, you're as horrible as it is, if you lost your children or if your children lost you at a young age, everybody will experience loss, and it's overcoming that unites people, to me.
Right, right. Or when John drops a bottle of whiskey and it breaks, you know.
Yes.
Well then I cry for a week. I mean, you know. It's usually very good whiskey.
You're like...
I was going to say, that has to depend on what kind of whiskey it is, I'm sure.
But
corner store stuff, no.
Yeah, no. But, yeah, you know, to go the other way with that... I actually know what it's like to have that talk with your mother, because my mother actually sat us all down. I'm one of 5 kids, and had that talk with us at one point too. And she had, she had breast cancer. So she had a double mastectomy, and you know, she's still with us. So
that's awesome. It's like, my mother always told me from a very young age, is like, you're never going to understand life. You're never going to understand why things happen. She's like, the best thing you can do is figure out how to deal with it, and figure out how to use it and harness it. Yeah. Because James had a certain sense of freedom. My parents, my mom was like the liberal, my dad was the conservative, all that kind of stuff. And we were told to explore, told to like question everything, figure out what you want to do with your life, and do nothing but that. Push everything else aside And like everybody in life, you're never really good at pushing everything else aside because you get caught up and mired and like, oh, I love this woman. And then you're like, no, I don't. What am I thinking? Then you get, like, stuck, you get stuck in a dead end job and you're like, ugh. But then it takes, I have this quote that I tell people all the time. Death is the greatest motivator, if not the greatest teacher. That death will change everything. It changes your outlook on life completely. James knows it. That's why James and I work really well together, is because you look at both of us, and I won't say soulmate because I said soulmate last time, but we look at each other, and I will never live that soulmate comment down from
life. No, you won't. No, you won't, because first she goes, they're partners in crime, and then immediately goes into the soulmate talk. Oh, God.
But what do you guys spoon every night? I just
it's Captain Innuendo for the win.
Yes, but it's the I forgot what I was gonna say. all the spooning talk, man. You guys are man.
Being around your soulmate makes you nervous. I understand.
I just now remember what I was gonna say. And when James and I first met each other, it was like almost like a click. You can tell if somebody's been through trauma or tragedy.
Right.
You can tell if it's holding them back, or you can tell if it's elevating them. And James and I have come to a point where James has this great quote where he says he doesn't want to leave his children a tomb. He wants to leave his children a monument that they can build their lives upon. It's the same principle I have with my career goals, everything that I'm doing. That's what inheritance is built out of. It's built out of that passion and fire of going, we've had stuff knock us down, but we're going to pick ourselves right back up, and we're going to turn the worst tragedies and pain in our lives into something that can affect change in other people. And that's something that a lot of media lacks these days. Like yes. Art or movies, books, it's all done from a glacial aspect of, oh, that's pretty, that's awesome, looking great. And James and I come from a very aspect of, what does that have to do with the story? That's pretty and stuff. Remember I told James, it was like, dude, we should have a car chase. There should be cars rolling. He's like, why? I'm like, just be cool. He's like, okay, cool is not working. And then there's pieces of artwork where he's like, this looks so cool. I'm like, doesn't work. He's like, dang. But that's why we work together really well as creators, because we both created inheritance.
Yeah. We're not afraid to tell each other when we are basically linking donkey balls, and we're not afraid to tell each other when we actually.
Wow, that's an interesting descriptor. That's such an interesting descriptor, James.
Awesome.
Yeah, especially
some of our ideas, Shu, aren't that good.
Though, I think what's actually most fascinating about both your stories, and it's something that anyone listening to this really should take away from this story, is that, you know, true art comes from pain. And, you know, like when you're watching a TV show. Someone had a motorcycle go through their house. When you're watching a comedy on a sitcom on TV, or even worse, reality television, you know, there's no art there. It's appealing to the lowest common denominator to get a large audience and get people to watch it. You know, even it's true with Spider-Man and Superman comic books, like, they're not there to really tell an artful story. They're there to entertain someone for a month, you know, for an issue until the next one comes out. But what a lot of people who have real pain in their life, and real tragedy, are always so quick to shut down and not learn from that and not move forward from that, you know? And,
I think a lot of that comes from, in a society, the weakness, people look at any form of, especially in men, any form of like crying and tears and pain, and the need to look at someone and go, hey, tell me this is going to be okay.
Right.
That they look at that as some form of weakness. So it keeps people from kind of addressing a lot of the issues head on, because they're afraid of what people will perceive them as.
No, that's very true. I mean, and that's, you know, I think we're getting a little better as a society, you know. Yeah. I mean, you look at our parents' generation and their parents' generation, like, you know, a man couldn't even hug his children, you know. You got a handshake the day you were born and a handshake on your high school graduation, you know. And so we're
not
getting
from my dad. He tried to get me a hooker when I was 16. I got a little bit more than a handshake.
Wait, but but he got you a hooker. He didn't, you know.
No, I said he tried to. Totally different story.
But there's a difference between but there's a difference between your dad getting you a hooker and your dad bending you over.
Oh, thank God.
Whoa.
So, my dad was out there.
So I think I would hope as a society we're getting a little better. But yeah, no, it's you know, and even like you had said that you had wanted to make movies to make your mother laugh.
Yeah.
You know, because some people will say, how can there be, especially when people are close to a tragedy, like, you know, it just happened or even it happened a month ago. How can anything funny come from this, you know?
Yeah. It's a, I tell people, my mother died in 2009. And I tell people this all the time. I told James this a couple times was, as my mother always told us, she's like, you'll never understand anything in life until you're a couple of years past it. And my mother, when she passed away, it still wrecks me to this day. There's still times where a song or a movie will play and it'll just drop me to my knees. And I'm down for a day because I can't get past it. Because that loss becomes ripped wide open and you're like, holy God.
It's nature survivor's guilt, dude. That night when we won the award, that totally floored me. And yeah.
But I mean, I look at this and I tell people this all the time where I can see the positives out of the death of my mother, where I'm so far away from the situation that I can evaluate it from not a knee jerk reaction to it. I look at it and go, okay, she's no longer in pain and she wanted nothing but her children to succeed. Her and my father fought like hell to make sure that would happen so that if I stopped and if I didn't take the loss of her and that pain that it instilled in me and do something great with it, it's almost like she would fail and then I would fail and that I won't let that happen. I won't sit there and I don't want to look at my children's face when I have kids and go, your dad failed because I never tried. I would rather look at my kids and go, your dad succeeded because I did this. Do exactly what I did, but in your own career path and whatever you want to do. That's the thing with people. It's like anything in life that's painful or traumatic, it's surmountable. At a certain point, you'll be able to kind of begin to, your head will come above the water and you will no longer feel like you're choking and drowning. You'll start to be able to swim. And then that island that you need to swim towards, it'll slowly start gradually getting closer and closer and closer with every single day. And then before you know it, you're standing on this island and you're constructing a life.
Right.
But
yeah.
That's what art does for people, especially if it's art directly from somebody that is not only art, but it's profitable. So it reaches a massive audience. What it does is it allows somebody to see another person's pain and tragedy and realize, okay, it's not impossible. That's what inheritance is all about. It's showcasing that to people and going, look at what you can do if you just take the pain into your life, turn inwards and build with it. You can become unstoppable if you only take the stuff that's like holding you back and holding you down and turn it into something amazing.
Right. No. Yeah, definitely. And you know,
I think Terry Pratchett did stuff like that.
Yeah.
A lot of his Discworld books were like mirrors of society, and they were fun reads until you realized that he was describing stuff like racism and incarceration and all this other stuff. There were shades in his book that you don't get until you take a step back. And I guess he had some bad things happen in his life, and he poured it out and came up with this entire world to show us ways around grief and anger. And you know, you're describing the exact same thing.
Exactly. It's like Ernest Hemingway had this quote, and I posted it to my Facebook this morning because someone posted it. I was like, hey, I love that quote. Completely forgot about that. Where he said, there's nothing really much to writing. All you do is you sit at a typewriter and you bleed. That's where the real stuff comes from.
Yeah, but when Hemingway said it, he meant with a, you know, use a knife so that you could have something to use as ink.
It's like, you know, squeeze my blood into the ink canister and go.
Oh, it was Hemingway, you know.
Touche.
All right, so.
So now that we've talked about all that, where does Ash and an evil ancestor come into this, because you've described people that you have great respect for, and yet this story involves somebody very bad.
right. Coming back. I was going to say, what, let's talk about the book a little. Yeah. So,
all right. Okay. Ash.
It's talking about Walter.
There's Evil Dead fill into this.
Yeah. So Evil, it was said Evil Dead. So Inheritance comes from a very personal story that's very related to my mother and I. And when we were young, really young, before my mother had cancer and stuff, we were living in New York, and I remember this distinctively, sitting in a room with a bunch of kids, my mom and other people from the family in that room, and they started bringing up an ancestor. And I remember everybody stood up, they grabbed the kids, and they pushed us into the other room and slammed the door shut as hard as they could. And I remember looking at my sisters and other people going, whoa, I have a young kid going, okay, it's weird. But we heard my mother arguing, going, do not ever bring that person up around my children. Do not ever bring this shit back into my life. Leave it out of it. Huh. And my mom, we went home that night. My mother told us, she's like, you will never, ever hear this story until you're ready to hear it. And when I was 16, when my mother started writing a book, and we then began to realize the amount of paranormal activity that was within our family. And then we began to get the full story of stuff that happened when we were young. And seeing the ideas of, like, I remember my mother writing, and this may sound weird, but we had a subfloor in our house, and it was locked. And the only way into it was through a locked little gate. And we heard three thuds as hard, like someone smashing a sledgehammer under the floor. And my mom screams, and my dad's like, what? So my dad bolts outside, jumps underneath the floor, and he's thinking, okay, it's pipes. It's got to be this. It's got to be that. There's nothing underneath us. I heard it. My mother heard it. And my other sister heard it. And I was like, okay, this is interesting. And the fire alarms would go off while my mother was writing this book. And it all comes from family. So when my mother died, she never really – she released the book. But there's a bunch of stuff that happened with the book where the book was stopped. And one of the things I told her was, like, I'll take our story, her and I story, and I'll turn it into something – phenomenal, something that's very paranormally, like, centered, because there's so much stuff that's way too detailed to discuss in, like, a certain set, like an hour setup. I mean, we heard voices constantly, we saw shadows constantly, doors would open and close constantly in our house while my mother and I were sitting there, and the rest of my sisters were sitting there. So it's something that we were surrounded by. And it was almost like it was crazy. So I took those concepts and those experiences of paranormal with my mother. And I turned it into this story. And I turned it into the story of Serling Normandy, a motorcycle mechanic who has his mother committed because she sees spirits and she hears voices and stuff. So he has her committed. And then while she's committed, he begins to see those same spirits. So curiosity kills the cat. He begins to delve into her past. And in delving into her past, he finds an ancient ancestor who was exorcised from the world, who is this horrible, vicious, cruel person. And he unwittingly unlocks him and brings him into the world. And his whole goal is the total and complete eradication of his family. And a lot of that horror is the stuff I experienced as a kid. Stuff that you couldn't understand and stuff. And Inheritance follows two generations. It's the generation of a mother as she's dying of cancer, and then that same woman as an 8-year-old girl, and she gets locked in a basement, and her great-grandfather is unleashed into the world, and he begins to totally decimate the entire family, and the family has to confront the very thing that they feared. But what makes it worse is it's the very thing they cannot see at all. So it's entering a room and knowing it's here, and you don't know how you're going to stop it. Is that kind of horror.
All right. And so, I mean, and it sounds like it's very close to your own personal story.
Yeah.
And so it's not a romantic comedy, but...
no.
So how did
that'll be the sequel.
How did James and yours shared love of Army of Darkness fit into the...
It's a horror. It's... Go ahead, James.
Well, it's not – I think it would be more of, like, the love of, like, things that are in the black.
Okay.
Like, Army of Darkness is this absolute, like, serenade to that which is campy. And I absolutely love that part. Now, on a visual level, when you watch Evil Dead and you watch Army of Darkness and stuff like that, when they're getting to the scary parts, and when I say scary parts, I think everybody knows I'm not talking about Army of Darkness. But in Evil Dead 1 and 2, all the scary stuff happens in the dark. They weren't afraid to let things be dark. One of the problems in modern horror storytelling is that the slasher films like Saw and I don't watch them very much. Things like that have turned like gore into a high definition thing, where the performance of being scared comes from seeing somebody hanging by their entrails in an entryway in high definition,
or hearing like a jump scare with a really loud sound.
Yeah, and that's not really the way we like to tell stories. Like, it needs to show things that are scary. They need to come out of the dark. They need to let your mind stew. Like that scene in Evil Dead when Ash is walking around in the basement in the very first one, when he's got like the one shot shotgun and he's like this 18-year-old kid and he's walking around in that basement. Everything is black down there.
Right.
They let it stew. They let it build up, you know, before a pipe burst and shoved gallons of blood down his throat. But they let it stew. The reason why the scene was scary was because they let it simmer. They let it build up. And a lot of storytelling right now is just too rushed, especially when you get into stuff that's scary.
I can't remember. I think it was M. Night Shyamalan, and it's blasphemous as everybody doesn't like this guy. He had a really great, really great quote. I think it was M. Night Shyamalan. Where it was, it's not scary to cut from someone in the room going, I'm scared, to the killer with a knife. What's scary to, like, all the old school directors, and it was still what's scary to people now, is being locked in a room without a light, and you know there's a vicious creature in there that you can't see that wants to kill you.
Right, because his thing was, it's what's in your mind is scarier than what's on the screen.
Yeah, he completely stole that from Alfred Hitchcock.
Right.
When we translate that into the comic books, some of my favorite works are by like James O'Barr's The Crow, as an example.
Okay.
And, oh God, I love James O'Barr's work. in that book, like he doesn't just walk up and kill like all eight of the bad guys all at once. Mm-hmm. That wasn't any fun. That thing was a straight up bug hunt. It took, you know, 200 pages for him to hunt down each one of the guys. They didn't rush it. They didn't.
Right.
It made, when he finally went after T-Bird, the fact that he saw Funboy twice and talked things through with him and then killed mm-hmm. him, killed all those minions and all that other stuff. It was better because it wasn't just one big flying fart fest of a fight. And it needs to simmer like that. And it's the same thing with horror. It's the same thing with all storytelling. You need to let the story breathe. And I'm all for continuity in comics, and I'm also all for books that want to tell a story straight up in one shot, and they all have their different moments, and they all have their different things. But when it comes to something like horror, it gets so much more magnified by letting it simmer and breathe organically. And that's kind of the stuff that we go through with both visually and from the element of storytelling. Like, Shu and I drop the shadows inside of the thing. Like, if you look real close in the book, in the darkness, if you look real close, you'll see, like, shadows of ghosts inside of the shadows. It's not just a shadow. Look, there's a foot sticking out of the shadow. Or, look, there's a footprint where there shouldn't be any footprints. Or there's, you can see a hat on somebody's head in the darkness and stuff like that. And it's there, and it's subtle, and it's meant to just keep that feeling like if there's something there all the way through the prologue. And
I'm trying to think of, I just lost my train of thought. Keep going.
it's called you're describing dramatic tension.
Yeah.
And it's like the difference between Kill Bill 1 and Kill Bill Volume 2. Kill Bill Volume 1 was the slugfest, bloodfest, everything goes. Kill Bill Volume 2 was a slow burn up until the big meeting between her and Bill.
Yeah, which got in 10 seconds.
Yeah, but okay, so the payoff was a little bit bad, but still, there was that tension.
It was terrible.
Yeah.
See, we were asked at the last con we were at, they're like, what's your favorite horror movie? And undoubtedly, I always tell people it's The Shining, because it's such a slow paced film that gets you to love these people. And then they begin to, then the father begins to turn on him, and you're like, oh my God, this is going to be insane. Holy shit. And you're desperately trying to, like, you're looking at him going, please pay attention. Your husband and father is going insane.
Yeah.
It's that same kind of thing. And that only happens if you take the time to allow these characters to build themselves, to have worlds where it's a slow paced, but it's tension filled, where you know something's coming and it's coming slowly. And you're like, oh God. And eventually, you know, you're going to get to that point where it all just explodes. But until that point, you're stuck with these people as they see the inevitable and they can't help but go towards it.
Right. Yeah. You can add the original Alien and Carpenter's Thing from the 1980s into those.
Alien, I will
100%. Oh, I loved the Thing. I loved that movie.
Yeah, because talk about slow burns with the audience going, "Oh crap, no, run, well, just like, run."
It's like you look at like horror films these days and stuff, and the problem is you watch like the scary movies and you're like, okay, I'm going to be scared. And then like Paranormal Activity. Great. First movie. I love the first movie. And then it just kind of got lazy where it's just like, all of a sudden you're supposed to, there's a creature coming and then whack, this really loud sound jump scares you. And
right, right.
You're jump scared. You're not scared by tension. You're scared by someone whacking a pan right next to you going, thanks, jerk. and the other problem with that is it's like a lot of like horror movies are now doing false scares continuously. So instead of building people to the front of their seats and you're leaning forward, you're scared of, oh, that's not scared. So they lose that dopamine level that they built, and they kind of just relax and they're laughing and they're no longer filled with fear and tension.
Yeah, you become a nerd to it. It's like if everything's a jump scare, then nothing's really a scare anymore.
That's exactly right. That's what James and I was the first rule James and I said. Nothing that is false and nothing that's a jump scare. Let this story build its tension and build its fear.
Right.
You don't know why you're terrified, you don't know why it's there, but it's there. It's like
Right. Yeah. I mean a good horror story doesn't necessarily make you jump when you're watching it, but when you're done watching it, you have that creepy, scared feeling for a long time.
Yeah, it's like, yeah. James and I talk about this all the time. One of my favorite zombie film ever was Return of the Living Dead.
And I'm still not watching it any ever
again. I will make you watch it again.
I am not watching goddamn zombies.
I was a gullible kid. And when I saw when I first saw the movie, it said all the names and events in this movie are real, based on real events. I was like, shit, they're real. Oh my God. And then the other part was the fact that the corpses could not be killed. So that you're facing,
it's just petrifying.
You're facing something that can't be killed. It won't stop ever. And that's where we took the main villain of Inheritance, was where like, it's not a zombie. It's not anything like that. It's this malevolent force. It's this malevolent force that exists within this family that can't be stopped by guns, by fists, by axes and swords. Nothing can stop it. And you have to figure out how to kill it. That, to me, is absolutely terrifying. That every single thing you have, your crosses, crucifixes, which is the same thing, obviously, Bibles, holy water, none of that stops it. How are you going to stop it?
You take the ring to Mount Doom.
Exactly. Oh, right. That's the best way to describe it.
You
damage
attack
would
the
just
dark
say you find the right ammo. Oh, dang it. He beat me to the quote.
Oh, sorry.
I love that.
So
long since I heard that.
Yeah, I know. You know, the kind of thing that you're describing, the one monster that got me was the blob.
We talking about the X-Men or the gelatin one?
Oh God, no! The original 1950s, the one that you couldn't shoot, you couldn't set it on fire, you couldn't kill it, and it just kept coming, and it
was
wasn't
giant,
there were no jump scares, you know.
Oh yeah.
But anyway, so yes.
Right. So you guys are obviously, you know, you're not looking for jump scares. You're not looking to put out one issue of just gore and horror. Do you have a plan in place? Like, are you looking to do a continuing story? Or are you looking to do a 10-issue arc?
What we have we signed with Outpouring Comics, obviously.
Right.
They've signed on for the entire concept. James and I have this concept of three series. In each series, there's 9 books, with each book being about 30 pages. And it's a widespread arc of the story that we won't go into too much detail, but it follows these two timelines, these two, a little girl and her parents and her family trying to fight against this great-grandfather, and certainly her son trying to fight against that same great-grandfather. And it's built and designed as... we love serial fiction, the stuff that continuously goes on, like maxi series, so to speak. So we have it designed to be a multifaceted, multi-part story.
All right. So, okay, but you don't have a definitive...
No, it has an end to it.
Okay.
And you already know it?
Yes. Yes, we do. All we have this, the whole thing's planned out, practically.
All right, if it involves a ring and lava, I'm out.
No.
Oh, no ring and lava.
Okay.
It involves motorcycles and women on chalkboards. Not really.
There's motorcycles.
There's motorcycles. That's what makes James excited about it. He's like, motorcycles! But then I compensate for his giddiness by making him draw, like, 1950s cars. He's like, oh, no,
I love 1950s cars. He picked, like, one of the ugliest cars ever made, and it's so complicated.
The 1954 Lincoln Continental. It's not ugly. It's beautiful. Quick one.
Yeah. And then, as far as the motorcycles, I have this huge pet peeve. I'm offended by people who don't draw motorcycles correctly.
So, really?
Right. Well, yes.
Like, all those old Ghost Rider books, some of them are done right, but then you pick one up and you look at it and go, oh, they're trying to draw an FXR and the exhaust pipes are on the wrong side of the motorcycle. Why does it have two carburetors?
You know, that's because it's Satan. Yeah.
It is Satan.
Satan, it's just to bug you.
Oh, God, it drives me crazy. I'm the hugest Ghost Rider fan ever, and every time I pick one up and the bike is drawn wrong, I get furious.
Because the average Ghost Rider fan doesn't care.
That's all that
matters. James is part of like a 1% group of people who goes, damn you for putting the exhaust on the wrong side of the bike while everybody else is going, that's a cool looking picture. But but at the same time, I can't really make fun of him for it because I'm the guy who goes, that shoe looks weird. He's like, oh. He's like, really? I'm like,
dude, yeah, that shoe is in 1% of a shot that someone's going to look at for 10 seconds. The laces are weird. Redraw them.
Yeah.
He has to go back and fix it. He's like, oh, I hate you. But on the flip side, he's like, so, you know, James, you know, there's only supposed to be like 30 words per page. Yeah, like 60.
Panel.
He's like, dude, you have like 60 in here. I'm like, so? he's like, we might want to shorten that. I'm like, I don't think so. He's like, well, I fixed those shoelaces. I'm like, oh, okay.
So I have to ask. I still want to know about the willful destruction of property that you described.
Okay. Yeah. All right, real quick. So James Burton did storyboards on a film of mine called Vigil. And I had worked with a couple guys for practically a decade, the other one for like 5 years. And this is the first film that we all got a budget for. It was great. We shot with like a 30-person crew. We shut down streets in Reno, Nevada and stuff. It was going great stuff. We're in the post. One of them, who was a visual effects guru, and I'm doing air quotes, mind you, kept missing deadline after deadline after deadline. And I'm like, look, dude, you're missing deadlines. This has to be done at a certain point. Keep working until you're done. You've been paid. So that night I left, and I left my drive at his place. I come back the next day, I'm locked out. And those two guys that I had worked with forever and brought them into this film and helped push their careers a little bit farther, they took the film and ransomed it back along with another producer.
Wow.
And we had to hire an attorney. We got the attorney. The attorney threatened to destroy companies, threatened to destroy them. Eventually they released it, but they released it by destroying.
Yeah, they basically took all the work that they did and held that back and just gave the raw footage.
Oh, no, they gave the raw footage unlabeled. They gave the audio footage unlabeled. They changed the formats and everything just to be pretty. But the plus side to it is those two guys and another person really are not working in film anymore because this industry is so tiny that if you screw somebody over, it spreads like wildfire. And you become synonymous with someone who steals products. No one's going to want to tag you on their cruise.
Wow. Right.
The most frustrating part about it is that there were a bunch of us that didn't get –
like that were willing to not get paid so that those two dudes
could get paid.
And the producer could get paid because they had to buy equipment and do all this stuff to do it. And it was like this mixture of the stuff of, I mean, it was such a good job that everybody had put into it. Like, I got to see the footage when it was like in the midpoint. The actors were nailing their lines. One of them, honestly, was probably the best work he'd ever done in his entire life. Yep. And these guys, just because they wanted more money than what they'd agreed to do the film, it all fell down, and it was like a worst case scenario.
It was very disheartening. It was disheartening, but what it did to me was like, okay, I need to have control. I need to no longer have to rely on other people. So then I went to James, and I have to rely on James, but James I consider a brother. It's a rare, there's not that many people I would consider that to me. Where when we start talking about inheritance and stuff, he's like, let's do it. He's like, because he was pissed. He's like, what the hell? Because James did storyboards. He boarded the entire film. But those guys, karma's already come back. They can enjoy whatever they're doing. I don't care what they're doing. The only reason I'm talking about it is because you guys asked about it.
And that's kind of why we like working with Outpouring so much. John and Sam and Steve and all them. We got brought in, introduced to them through a friend of mine named Don Smith, he's the writer on Vampire, The Lost Highway, and I work on that book with him intermittently. And it's a great book, and he introduced us, these guys, at Outpouring. And as we started talking to them, even though we were talking to like a couple different publishers trying to figure out how we wanted to go at it, Outpouring was so confident not only in their plan on how they wanted to handle things, but in the fact that creators should be the ones driving the story and driving the vision for whatever the project is, and that we definitely felt very strongly that they had our backs on it. So it was a good setup, and so far we're enjoying the experience.
I mean, you learn from these things. You learn from what people do, and you're like, okay, I'm never gonna do that again.
Right.
you keep the grass around your house cut so you can see the snakes come up. So when you see a snake, you just chop its head off and you push it out of the way. When James and I started talking Outpouring and stuff, I mean, they initially said, hey, we know we love this book. We know we're up and coming. We would love to be able to bring you guys on, but we understand if you guys want to go somewhere else. That, to us, spoke so much more than anything else. It was because they just wanted a shot to see if they could take the book. So when we talked to them, we did a couple of meetings with them. They loved the book. They loved where we were going with the new stories and the new characters and stuff. And James and I just said, okay, these are the guys. Something about it clicked because I trusted my gut. On that last film, the film that was stolen, I remember the day I wrapped, my gut said, take my hard drives away from both of those guys. That was the last time I will never listen to my gut.
Yeah.
Because if I listened to my gut, that film would be out.
Yeah.
Could you do everyone a favor and write a letter of recommendation for those guys to whoever is directing the next Fantastic Four movie?
I don't think that'll happen.
If we can get those two guys to go work for Sony, then maybe that would fix a lot of the problems. Stop before they get out.
Jesus.
You know what? I wouldn't be shocked if those guys were on that project, because that's the exact kind of stuff that I know one of them is like totally like that. What if we do this? And it's like, oh my God, I can already hear his voice.
I heard the effects on that were not that great anyways.
Nah. All I gotta do is watch the trailer of Fantastic Four and go, nope. I'm gonna pirate that shit off the internet. But I'm not gonna pirate the internet, and you should pirate
it and regret it.
Yeah. You're like, oh, I want my money back. I want my time back.
So this is a kind of a down the road question. I don't know if you've thought that far ahead, but given your background in movie making, do you envision doing, you know, movies based on inheritance?
Yes. Okay. James and I have already talked about it. Not so much movies, because we're kind of forecasting everything. I work with a bunch of good guys, like Matt Sconce, awesome dude, Ford Austin, amazing producers, guys, straight up one of the best guys I've ever met. John Hollis, he produced my last film, The Astronaut. These guys are all guys that I've worked with that I consider friends and brothers and stuff. And all of them have begun to see the signs. When I was in France for Cannes, every single distributor that I talked to were like, get out of film. Because the day of being able to watch a movie on your cell phone is here. So Netflix and Hulu have taken over. And so James and I have talked about like eventually turning this stuff into a television series.
Okay.
Like,
while we have talked about that and we're excited about those potential things down the road.
It's nowhere near us right now.
Yeah, we are just concentrating on getting the books done right now. We got our first deadline coming up in the spring and there's a lot of hustle left. We're totally excited that it's got the potential to be something like that, and there's different, you know, things that we're doing and talking about, but yeah, we got so much left to rock and we're doing it, but we got a long way to go.
Well, and okay, and I guess that's a good next question. Now that you are, you know, you two guys working together and you decide you want to do a comic book, you're kind of on your own schedule at that point, but now that you're working with Outpouring Comics, I'm sure they're like, oh, you know, we want to release it on this kind of schedule.
That's kind of there, but as James will definitely tell you, I'm very hard driving. I'm like, go, but do not, I'm like, no quality drop, nothing but go. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh God. So it puts deadlines on us, but it also lights that fire to keep pushing us so that you don't kind of lag. But all of our stories, everything is all done with a hard driving aspect. It's hard driving and heart wrenching is what I tell people.
Cool.
So Outpouring gives us deadlines and that they're like, okay. But I tell James, I'm like, let's beat the deadline. Let's come in at the time. Now, John, my fabulous publisher, don't count on that. don't count on us beating that deadline. So just stick with the normal deadline. Just don't count on it. Now I go, guys, what the deadline is, it done yet? Damn it.
John, I already hear that enough.
I will say this for John. Like, this is just from what I'm seeing on the outside. He seems to be not only wanting to publish the book, but he seems to be a cheerleader for you guys too. Like, when we did our live show a couple weeks ago, he said, could I please come up and make an announcement about Inheritance being part of our company now? And I was like, sure, you know, and then like right away, he's like, oh, you have to get these guys on the show. It'll be great. And so yeah, he's definitely rooting for you.
It's like what we love about John is he's not like the publisher that's like, hey, get this done or figure everything else out. He's in the trenches with us.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, go, let's figure this out. So he's doing media, he's doing book outreaches, he's doing all this kind of stuff to figure out book placements and going here and there and stuff. That's something you don't get from that many people these days.
No.
I mean, it's that hard to find that we just did. Whew.
I mean, we've done two Comic Con appearances with Inheritance, and we've sold out both completely of all books. This last con, we sold out the reader copy.
Oh, okay.
And John's there going,
yeah, we had four or five different people trying to bid for the.
Cool. I mean, and then like 3 days later, the copies that the publisher had sold out. And John's like, we're sold out completely. It's like, I guess we're going to do like back orders and stuff. And they're getting the printers to start printing more and stuff. So John's sitting there going, oh my God, this is amazing. And we're looking at John going, this is amazing. Welcome aboard. Cause we told him, I told John, I'm like, dude, I'm hard driving. This is what I want to do. If you're with us, jump on this train. It's not going to stop and it's going to keep going. It'll smash through every single obstacle you can throw at us. If you don't want, hop off. And he jumped on and I was like, holy crap, this is great. And Outpouring, the team at Outpouring, John, cause it's not just John, his wife, Sam, all these other guys that are involved in this company are like pushing so hard and doing so much work that most people wouldn't even think to attempt to do just to see this book succeed.
Right.
And that to us is one of the greatest aspects because we found a publisher and a group of guys that is not only a bunch of dorks like we are, but they're as driven and as passionate as we are. So we're not having to sit there and go, cheerlead everybody, go, we're going to do this. We go, we're going to do this. And I've gotten used to John on Facebook sending me a thumbs up because I'm going to go, we're starting media outreach. We got the media to come out. People were calling. People were literally picking up our book, reading it, listening to a story of James and I with cancer and stuff, and they were calling the media for us. So the media would come out to talk to us. And I would preface it with, before the con, I would call every single media outlet, invite them out, and then let the world do the rest of its bidding. And
that's what led to us being interviewed by Goku.
Yeah, we got interviewed by two guys. One guy was dressed as Goku.
Oh, God, really?
Super Saiyan, yeah. Goku.
Is Super Saiyan God Super Saiyan or just Super Saiyan?
No. Level 1 Super Saiyan. He had the shorter hair, but it was yellow and stand up, and it was a lot of fun. Those are the fandom guys for the movie. No, we tried to get it going, but you know, you can only do so much against gravity and stuff.
Oh, we're not too geeky.
No, not at all.
Anime rocks.
Are you sure?
I think John would be more excited if they were dressed as Rainbow Dash, but that's another story.
Whoa. No, Super Saiyan Goku Rainbow Dash.
Oh,
wow! There's a combo right there.
That's terrible. I'm gonna go scrub. I'm gonna go Photoshop my eyes.
Well, you, okay. you
there was a pony that could be Super Saiyan though. It would definitely be Rainbow Dash.
Oh my gosh, we're talking My Little Pony.
Hey, mock My Little Pony, because I can have Camille come in here and thug you up right now.
She would thug me.
I don't know who this Camille is, but I am totally with her.
It's his daughter.
Camille is my daughter, and she is awesome. She's the one who was born right before I was diagnosed, but she's definitely, like, she was so upset that I wouldn't let her go to AnimeCon because she wanted to be there and she wanted to get dressed up and stuff, which is awesome. But if I'm tabling, I can't take her to the bathroom. And right. I'm not sending my 8-year-old daughter dressed as like whatever superhero she wants to be into the restroom at a con by herself. It's not gonna happen.
Yeah.
All right.
She was gonna show up and do the Wonder Woman things.
Right. I'm sitting here debating something to myself, and I'm gonna make this announcement right now because John, you have inspired me.
No. Okay. Whatever it is, no.
Oh God.
I don't want to know.
New York. Scared. New York Comic Con is coming up, and I will be there, I will be at Greg Horn's table in Artist Alley. So if somebody comes by Greg Horn's table dressed as Super Saiyan Rainbow Dash, I will have a special gift for you. All right?
Oh, that is awesome.
You can't flip them the bird as their special gift.
No. It's going to be... I have a couple different comics that I can give you, or maybe a print from Greg Horn. So, come on now, this is for everyone out there. It's going to be at New York Comic Con. Show your love for superhero speak by dressing as Super Saiyan Rainbow Dash.
That won't be love for superhero speak. That'll be something completely different.
Dude, now I feel like I need to do like Rainbow Dash Super Saiyan sketch cards.
Oh, jeez. If you do, I want a signed one. I will pay for that.
What is going on?
Dude, My Little Pony combined with Kung Fu and like superhuman combat is an awesome combination. Let it happen. It's all good.
That's the season 4 finale, is what you just described. You'd have to see it, but yeah, they did actually go Super Saiyan in the finale.
They did? That's awesome.
Yeah. Ask your daughter. She probably saw it.
Perfect. Perfect. That's it. My and you will make my New York Comic Con if that happens. It's all I'm saying.
So Inheritance comes out when?
Right now it's kind of slated for early 2016.
The prologue is out.
You can currently buy the prologue issue through outpouringcomics.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/inheritnovel. And then as we retweet daily, as we get closer to the release and stuff, we'll be able to like announce the release. I know we're coming up to Sacramento Con, the SatCon. In October, we're actually going to be debuting a new cover to the first issue of the first series at that convention.
Which is hella creepy.
Yes. It's quite awesome.
I'm looking at it right now, and I'm still creeped out by these things that I drew.
So it's early 2016. The people that currently have the book, we've gotten reviews back from them where people are like, I want more. Why is this not done yet? So we're getting really good reactions to the book. Cool. So early 2016 is when it's coming out. You can buy the prologue at outpouringcomics.com.
Cool. And, I guess, are you guys going to be at any upcoming, are you guys going to be at New York or any other upcoming cons?
Outpouring is working on some con appearances for this year. And I talked to John. I know this weekend, I don't know if they're going to have copies of Inheritance's prologue, but they'll have them after that. As far as like Shu and I, we're over on the West Coast. Shu's in LA and I'm up by Sacramento. So our con appearances this year is, I think the last one is just SatCon. But we are talking Outpouring about maybe what we're going to do next year. They're kind of putting together what they want to do. So it's a little bit early for us to talk about that and be specific. I know they've mentioned some of the bigger cons like C2E2 and stuff like that, but it's totally like up in the air and everybody trying to figure that out. This year, that anime con that we went to was kind of a surprise thing. It was great. But if I'm going to make that deadline, I have many an hour to go before I am. If I do a ton of con appearances now, it ain't going to happen. That last one, that surprise one that we did was awesome, but it was, I would call that a time sink. It was worth it. Totally worth it. Going there and hearing everybody's reaction, sometimes you just need to do that to remind yourself why you're doing it, and it was worth it. But like I said, if I do that every freaking weekend, I'm not going to get this book done. So
right, cool. And I'm just going to throw this one out there too. So some of the cons, like some of the smaller ones, you really couldn't get away with this at New York or San Diego, but you can if you're going to be there in a group and you can suggest. Oh, you know, let's do a panel, you know, on this day. So if you guys want to do an inheritance panel, I'd be glad to moderate it for you.
That would be awesome.
All right. Maybe John will come along as well.
Yes.
But he would have to be dressed as Super Saiyan Rainbow Dash.
No.
It's going to be the most uncomfortable.
Dude, you just got to do it smart. You go Super Saiyan, you put your hair in 7 different colors, you put a Band-Aid on your nose, and you're good.
Nice. Oh my god.
Alrighty.
You're my co-creator? Man! But I love you.
You should see his ideas see his ideas for the sequel.
Well, if I were writing it, see that's one of the differences between Shu and I. If I were writing it, there'd be shotguns, chicks in bikinis, car crashes. All of that crazy stuff, and it wouldn't be Inheritance. It would be this big. The comic book I write is called Damage Incorporated, and it's like an explosion of guys astral stuff. It's like a combination between like, what did you say it was? It was
I said it's Ghostbusters meets Sons of Anarchy.
Yeah,
it's a bunch of dudes are like, let's go into business for each other. Yeah, let's do it. Let's go hunt creatures. Instead of getting a proton pack, we use TNT, grenades, guns, ammo, shotgun, and a bunch of smack talk. And let's go hunt some ghosts. Let's go hunt some demons and werewolves. And let's be really bad at it. Let's constantly blow stuff up. Let's constantly shoot at each other and go, oh, shit. I love Damage Incorporated. I love it. James is that's one of my favorite things James has ever written. Because it's written by, James wrote it with all of his, like, about all of his friends and stuff. I mean, I have my friends that are like very much like me. We play video games. I never got a D&D. A lot of James' stuff comes from D&D. A lot of my stuff comes from sitting with a group of dudes playing video games, getting drunk and going, yeah, let's do this. And then ultimately it would devolve into like one of us wearing a dress, dancing around. Like there's a wrestling game all my friends play and stuff. So they're like, dude, we need a ring girl. So a couple times, a couple of the dudes, myself included, have lost bets. I'm sitting there with my girlfriend. They've got their girlfriends, and I'm like, shit. So I have to put on my buddy's wife's dress and I come out with a ring card. I'm like, yay! And then the next round, someone else does it. We tend to punish each other that way. It's like, you lose a bet, wear a dress. It's not like, you owe me $20. It's like, you lost this bet, go do something stupid. Crap. So at a certain point, we all just stopped betting. We're like, nope.
Are you sure you want to admit all this out loud?
It's hilarious. It's
okay.
That's the thing that I like about James and I is we're very forthcoming with people. It's like you have to be. You have to. You can't lose sight of who you are.
Right.
And where you've come from. And a lot of people do that.
It's too hard to remember the lies. I'm bad at it.
A lot of people are like, well, I'm this great person and stuff. When nobody wants to know that. No one wants to know how rich you are and stuff. Nobody wants to know, is he a dumbass like me? does he do the most random things? And it's like, yes. It's why I love Keanu Reeves. It's why James and I both love Bruce Campbell. Is they're very forthcoming with what's been in their lives and the stupidity of it. It's own your weirdness and rock it like a rock star. That's how we do it.
All right. All right, guys. Well, actually, we're a little over an hour now, so.
Whoa.
Yeah.
See?
We've gone so long, I just placed my order for the Inheritance Prologue, so.
Yay!
It's on back order, John. You know.
Well, so what? I just ordered from Store Envy, so I'm good.
It won't be that long. And when I see you guys at a con, I'll sign it and crap.
Yeah. Oh, sweet.
You're going to have to pay me $150 for my signature.
So I'm getting it cheap.
Mine's for free. I'm a cheap date.
James puts out on the first night. I put out on the fourth.
Oh, yay.
Not everybody needs a wedding.
Say. I'm the guy you have to woo. You have to, like, hold my hand, tell me I'm sweet. Like, wait a second. Are you
kidding me, dude? I married my first date, and she was a blind date. I don't shop.
That's because she beat you and clubbed you like a baby seal, tagged you with a Trent gun, and said, mine.
Hey, some people are into that. Don't judge.
And you're paraded around as, like, this trophy husband. Your wife's like, this is my husband. His wife is such a sweetheart. I love his wife.
All right. All right, guys. Well, if you don't have anything else constructive to add.
Oh, hey.
So I'd just like to say, Mr. Schumacher, Mr. Burton, thank you for being on the show. Don't forget to check out Batman Forever coming to theaters in 1995. Oh, wait, sorry. Don't forget to check out Inheritance on outpouring.com. As usual, all the links will be in the description of the episode. And
don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Inherent Novel.
Yes.
And you know what?
I just did a horrible plug. Yes. So, like, be sure.
Thank you guys for letting us come on here and do this shameless self-promotion. We appreciate it.
Thank you guys so much. Super appreciate it. You guys rock.
No,
it's also hella fun. We've been on some podcasts that weren't. This one rocked. Thank you.
I did a radio show where the guy asked me the same question over and over and over again. I'm like, I'm done.
Well, on that note, as we say each and every week, boys and girls, don't let your cape get caught in the door. Have a good week.
Okay, now it's my turn. Okay, what are you doing? Taking over Dad's mic so I can be part of superhero speak. Duh. Well, there are better ways to join the conversation. Really? Like what? Well, you can interact with them on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and even Pinterest. Wait, people use Pinterest? And what's Google+? I don't know, something to do with circles. Anyway, you can also see all their posts, including comic book videos, on their website, where you can also sign up for their mailing list. Cool! Yep, are you still going to try to hijack Dad's mic? Nope, I'm going to try to answer the Stump the Geek question. Nice. So who do you think would win in a fight between Rainbow Dash and Squirrel Girl? That's a hard one. Oh no, Dad's waking up. Run for your lives!
Oh, what are you guys doing? That cape's gonna get caught in the door.